Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Stephen Hull's debut novel, The Raw Shark Texts, opens with a young Eric Sanderson waking up in a flat with no idea of who or where he is. He finds out only because the old Eric Sanderson, the one before the memory loss, has prepared a series of letters telling him his identity and what he should do next. The letters tell him, among other things, to surround himself with four dictaphones to protect him from the Ludovician. Now, the Ludovician is a thought fish, a gigantic conceptual shark. Soon Eric finds himself on the trail of the Unspace Exploration Committee to seek out crypto-conceptual oceanologist Dr. Trey Fedoris. And that, of course, is going to require a conceptual boat. Still with me? Don't worry about it. The Raw Shark Texts is a surprisingly accessible novel. Even the 50-page flipbook of an approaching shark late in the novel makes sense when you get there. But back to the beginning. Here's Steve Hull reading from the opening of the book.
I had no idea who or where I was. This was no sudden revelation, no big shock. The thought had congealed itself under the gasping and the choking, and even now, with my body coming back under control and the realization fully formed, it didn't bring any big horror or fear. Against all that physical panic, it was still a small secondary concern, a minor oddity at the corner of things. What mattered most to me, a million times more than anything, was air, breath, the easy lungfuls coming and going now, the beautiful, heavenly, angel-singing fact I could breathe, and that meant I would live. Pressing my forehead down into the wet carpet, I imagine breathing mile after mile of blue savanna sky as the last of the shudders worked their way out of my body. I counted to 10, then looked up from the floor, propped up onto my knees, when that seemed okay, all the way up. I was kneeling at the bottom of a double bed in a bedroom stocked with all the ordinary, usual things. There was a wardrobe in the corner, a bedside table with a collection of water glasses of varying ages and an alarm clock with red digital numbers, 4:34 p.m. A chest of drawers cluttered with deodorant cans and lids, a tub of multivitamins and the remains of a blue toilet roll, used right down to where the paper goes wrinkly, like bath fingers. All just normal bedroom things, but I didn't recognise any of them. None of it felt strange, but none of it was familiar either. It was all just there. Unremarkable, but alien, stuff. The thought came maybe I'd fallen and concussed myself, except nothing hurt. I felt around my skull to make sure, but no, nothing. I climbed carefully up onto my feet, but the new angle didn't do anything for my memory either. And that's when the first real stabs of worry started to land. It isn't all coming back to me. I don't know any of this at all. I felt that prickling horror, the one that comes when you realise the extent of something bad, if you're dangerously lost or you've made some terrible mistake, the reality of the situation creeping in through the back of your head like some pantomime Dracula. I did not know who I was. I did not know where I was. That simple. That frightening.
Here at the beginning of the story on the Raw Shark Text, we're introduced to Eric Sanderson. It's funny in a way, isn't it? I mean, at the very beginning, we almost know more than he does about who he is.
Yeah. You know, that was kind of conscious. I was thinking that when you start to read a book, really, you're kind of playing catch-up in a lot of ways. You're trying to catch up with the story and you're trying to catch up with a person's entire life that you've just met. And so I thought it would be interesting if you kind of get to know the lead character as he's getting to know himself, really.
Is this amnesia?
Well, depending on how you decide to read the book without spoiling it, but it's a kind of amnesia where all that seems to be missing from his life is himself. In so much as, you know, he can quote film lyrics, he knows the names of bands, he recognises things, but whenever a memory involves him physically doing something and actually being in the world, then he draws a complete blank as if he's been completely taken out.
I don't think it's giving away too much to talk about his relationship with Dr. Randall, the psychologist, whom he goes to almost immediately. She calls this, what, a psychotropic fugue?
She does, yeah. Indeed.
I don't know whether this is a genuine diagnosis or whether this is something that she has made up. What's involved? That, as you say, he's removed from all memories?
Yeah, he's kind of from his own perspective, completely taken out of the world. It is a real condition that people suffer from, and what happens is when it comes over them, they basically just leave. They run away from their own lives and completely forget everything about themselves. Actually, it was interesting. Not long after I'd finished writing the book, I was watching David Lynch's Lost Highway and watching a documentary with him, and he was saying that that whole film was also based on psychotropic fugue, which I had no idea about, so that was interesting.
Yeah. Now, what he does, of course, is to begin to try to find his place in the world, and he starts to get messages from himself, and he's clearly been through this before.
Yes. Yes. Well, first of all, he speaks to the doctor, and the doctor gives him a very reasonable, if not, you know, quite upsetting explanation as what's happened to him. And he has this mental condition, which means that his brain's at some point become emotionally overloaded, and, you know, he can't really deal with his life anymore. And so he's kind of suppressed it and blanked it out. And the doctor gives him this diagnosis and also says that, you know, if you're ever going to get better, don't ever read anything you might have written or left any notes for yourself before you woke up, before you had this blackout, because it could be very dangerous for you. But then within a couple of days, a letter arrives, and without him realizing it, he opens it and reads it, realizes it's a letter from his past self before the event took place, before his illness reoccurred. And it says, whatever you do, don't trust Dr. Randall. So he's left in a kind of a quandary.
So where does he go to start? How does he begin searching?
He finds yet another scrap of text and another letter from his past self, which tell him there used to be a trail which led right across the north of England, left by a possibly mad professor called Dr. Trey Fedorus. And Eric sets out, even though this trail must be 5 years old and there's probably not very much left of it, to look for, you know, fly-posted notes and left-behind graffiti that this man's left. And gradually this trail leads him further and further into unspace, which is the space kind of underneath or behind where we live most of our lives, and deeper down underground and deeper into forgotten things.
It takes a kind of physical presence at one point when he and a young woman he has found, who is his guide, go behind the bookshelves.
Yes, indeed.
There's a little section that I'd like you to read that I think gives a feeling of that.
Okay. We made our way through the shelves and silent stacks until we came to the bookcase where most of the novels by writers with surnames starting with H were shelved. Just these bottom four rows, Scout said. We need to unload them and stack them up at the side there. We did it quickly, taking the books out 8 or 12 at a time, squeezing our palms tight against the covers as we lifted them and piling them up wholesale in front of the G-case to our left. When this was done, Scout took hold of one of the empty shelves and lifted it up and out of the bookcase, placing it neatly next to the books. She removed the other two empty shelves in the same way and then got down on her knees to inspect the cases exposed back. Taking a small screwdriver from her big army coat, she was soon passing out to me 1, 2, 3, 4 small silver Phillips screws. Put them with the books, she said. As I did, Scout took a screwdriver and levered off the lower part of the thin wooden backboard, passing it out to me as well. Where the board had been, there was now a 3-foot by 4-foot rectangular black hole. That's where we're going, Scout said, getting to her feet and brushing herself off. Unspace. Yep. That's it. I took the rucksack off my shoulders and got down on my hands and knees to look inside. I could only see maybe 2 or 3 inches of bitty grey concrete floor before the space receded into complete black. The shop's dry, warm, processed air had made me start to sweat under my heavy coat, but the air coming out of the hole felt cool and hard, basic and factual, and telling stories of miles of stripped-down, empty places.
What's it like for you as the author to create unspace? I mean, it's almost as though it's going behind what you're writing.
I think there's an exciting idea that there is depth to story, and that where is that depth, actually? Is that depth in my imagination? Is it in your imagination as the reader? Or is it somewhere kind of in between? You know, we had for a long time, you know, the kind of almost the cult of the surface that came from postmodernism, where, you know, everything is just the printed black on the white. But, you know, I kind of think that we've kind of absorbed that, and we can accept that, yes, that all the book is printed text, but nevertheless, there is conceptual space behind those words, and that it's our right, and it's something we can do to go into there.
Stephen Hall's debut novel is called The Raw Shark Texts.